Coming up next on the Economic Club of Indiana, this month's speaker is President and CEO of Eli Lilly and Company, John Lechleiter. Lechleiter talked to the club about innovation, the cure for what ails us. He's been CEO of Lilly for 6 months. Lechleiter says he's optimistic about the company's future. He says Lilly is working to create value for shareholders by accelerating the flow of innovative new medicines to improve outcomes for individual patients.
That means clear patient focus, aggressive expansion into biotech, a leaner, faster company, a more global enterprise, and ultimately a more diversified business. In doing these things, we will bring forth innovation, which is the cure for what ails us as a company, as an industry, and frankly, as a society.
Eli Lilly President and CEO John Lechleiter speaks to the Economic Club of Indiana next. But first, this news. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Eli Lilly, President and CEO John Lechleiter, spoke to the club in downtown Indianapolis in September. Lechleiter talked about the poor image of the pharmaceutical industry and the need for more innovation. He also talked about the value of Lilly stock. Economic Club President Stephen F. Walker of Walker Information introduces Lechleiter.
From the laboratory to the boardroom, that's been the 30-year career for John C. Lechleiter, the recently appointed Chief Executive Officer of Eli Lilly and Company. In 1979, he joined the pharmaceutical giant to study chemical compounds as a senior organic chemist. In fact, he has spent much of his career at Lilly in research and development. That makes him one of an exclusive group of scientists who've gone on to become chief executive of a major pharmaceutical company. Lechleiter's passion for science is something that began early, developed as a schoolboy doing science fair projects. Later on, that led him to Harvard, where he earned both a master's degree and a doctorate in organic chemistry. Through the years, his other posts at Lilly have included Vice President of Pharmaceutical Product Development, President of U.S. Operations, and President and Chief Operating Officer. Since becoming CEO in April, he also now chairs the company's Operations Committee, as well as the Executive Committee. Colleagues say he is known for getting things done while also having the ability to relate to those who he works with. Speaking of his new role, Lechleiter said, "For me personally, it's a chance to realize the wonderful potential of the science that we have at our feet. The fire that burns within me each day that says I've been given an opportunity now to marry up this exciting science and meet some of these important needs that really do come home to me today and resonate with me more than ever before." His speech today is entitled "Innovation, the Cure for What Ails Us." Please join me in a warm Economic Club, Indiana, welcome to John C. Lechleiter.
Thanks, Steve, for that very kind introduction. I'm not sure whether or not to thank you for that quote in last week's IBJ when Steve promised everyone that I would, quote, blow their socks off as the first speaker for a new Economic Club season. Now, that's called setting a high bar, especially since I've now got some serious competition. As many of you know, this speech is going head-to-head with a very big downtown news event. They're deflating the RCA Dome just a couple of hundred yards from here. So I know what was going through your heads this morning. Let's see. Should I watch a wrecking crew suck the air out of the RCA Dome, or should I watch Lechleiter suck the air out of the convention center? I think you made the right choice. Worst case, you'll leave without your socks, okay? But at least the roof won't come down over here. It's been a full 6 months since I was given the honor and the responsibility of a lifetime when I became the CEO of Eli Lilly and Company. Lilly's one of the state's largest employers, and we all know that our company has a big impact on the economy, on local philanthropy and community support, and, of course, on our tax coffers. Clearly, there's a lot at stake for us and for you as leaders in this community. This afternoon, I want to give you a behind-the-scenes look at what we're thinking and planning at Lilly. I want you to know Lilly's strategy going forward and its potential implications for our city and for this region. And I want you to know why yours truly remains an unfettered optimist about Lilly and our prospects, not despite it all, but because of it all. Since that's my subject matter, I need to start by acknowledging three 800-pound gorillas. I'm not going to pretend that they're not in the room here today. So help me welcome gorilla number one. He's called the image of the pharmaceutical industry, and today he's one ugly dude. He can barely win a beauty contest against tobacco or big oil, and that's saying something. To see the daily news and to listen to the rhetoric of a lot of politicians, regardless of party, you would think that our industry and our products are the main reason why health care is so expensive. You might get the impression that we're cavalier about the safety and effectiveness of our products. And you would be led to believe that our major investments are television commercials, Washington lobbyists, and gifts for doctors. Ugly, just like I said. Now, let's welcome in gorilla number two. He's called the innovation drought, and he seems to give the lie to all of those wonderful stories we heard a few years ago about the decoding of the human genome, disease cures on the horizon, and the promise of personalized medicine. Last year, the U.S. FDA approved just 19 new medicines. To put that in perspective, it's the lowest number of new approvals in any year since 1983. That was a quarter century ago, when aggregate R&D spending in our industry was one-tenth of what it is today. Not good. And then there's gorilla number three. He's been making the rounds locally in particular, souring the mood at kitchen tables, cocktail parties, and foundation boardrooms alike. His name is the Lilly stock price. Boy, do I dislike this guy. And to think he used to be my best friend back in the day. In the middle of the year 2000, he was over $100 a share. 8 years later, as we gather here today, he's in the mid-40s. Sure, he's paid some nice dividends along the way. But what good is a gorilla that's losing weight? What's with this guy? Now, I could give you a speech putting each of these three gorillas in its place, setting the record straight, offering explanations, and providing context. In fact, I sketched out that speech, but it had a couple of problems. It was 3 hours long, for one thing, and I wasn't sure that you folks would cut me that much slack. But the bigger problem was that it missed the real point of my talking with you this afternoon. You'll see what I mean, even if I give you just a quick response to the three gorillas. First of all, it's demonstrably true that prescription medicines account for only about 10 cents of today's U.S. healthcare dollar, while delivering large savings elsewhere in the healthcare system. So it's frankly absurd to lay the many dysfunctions of the U.S. healthcare system at the doorstep of pharma. Also, there are very good reasons why branded prescription medicines cost so much, and it has next to nothing to do with TV commercials. It's the astonishing cost and risk of R&D in our industry. With 1 in 5,000 odds of success, 10 to 15-year timelines, and price tags well in excess of $1 billion on every new medicine that reaches the patient. But you know what? I can declare our bad image to be false, providing facts and figures all day long, but in the end, it won't matter unless we, our industry, can restore trust, and unless we deliver unambiguous benefit to as many people as possible. Those are the real challenges. In the same way, I could give you some good reasons why the industry's pipeline has been sluggish in recent years, but those rationales would not take away the imperative for us to get innovation moving. As for the Lilly stock price, well, the external political and regulatory environment in which our industry operates is certainly a factor. Skepticism toward the entire pharmaceuticals sector means that even solid performance has gone unrewarded at times. But a company leader railing against the unfairness of his stock price, it's like a kid railing against the unfairness of his report card. It's no fun to listen to, and it obscures the more interesting and important question. And that question is, son, what are you going to do about it? So let me tell you what we're doing about it at Lilly, beginning with our strategy. Now, maybe it's the scientist, the recovering chemist in me, but I fully believe that most every problem contains the clues to its own solution. You need to analyze the problem deeply, develop a set of hypotheses, and then test those hypotheses rigorously. Lilly's business strategy, which has three major parts, reflects just that kind of approach to the challenges we face. For example, in looking at the factors that contribute to our industry's image problem, we notice that something is strangely missing from the equation. There's plenty of discussion today about costs and risks. That won't go away, nor should it. What's often missing, however, is the element of benefit. We've got to change that. When our customers recognize clear economic benefit, we'll get much less pushback on cost. And when our customers recognize clear therapeutic benefit, we'll get much less pushback on risk. And we'll have even greater success as a business. And so the first element of Lilly's new strategy is to assure that the benefits of our products are unmistakable. The core of our strategy, indeed, our vision for our company going forward, is to consistently deliver improved outcomes for individual patients. Let me make this more tangible. Patients and even doctors don't usually define the benefits of treatment strictly in terms of laboratory measurements. For people with type 2 diabetes, for example, of course it's important to track glucose levels and other disease markers through blood work. But most of these people don't stand up and say, "Wow, that therapy is terrific. My HbA1c level is way down." Okay? Not in the circles I travel in. Instead, they might say, "Wow, I haven't had this much energy or felt so good in years. I was able to play catch with my grandkids yesterday. And this treatment is one that I can live with. It's not complicated or painful." Getting to that kind of outcome takes a different mindset than we've had in the past. Pharmaceuticals and lab tests are still in the mix for sure, but other things start to matter a whole lot more, such as injection devices that are easy to use or dosing regimens that make patients more likely to comply with doctor's orders, as well as education and diet and exercise and careful attention to the other treatments that a patient is receiving. It's also still the case too often that a medicine capable of working a miracle in you may have no impact whatsoever in me. That amounts to therapeutic failure and a huge economic waste, and it diminishes the perceived benefit of the medicine. So when I say that Lilly now aims to deliver improved outcomes for individual patients, I'm not trying to suggest we'll custom make medicines for every patient. I'll leave it to a future Lilly CEO to tell you all about that. But thanks to new science, it's increasingly within our grasp to target our R&D efforts on a subset of patients who have not been helped by earlier treatments. It's also within our grasp to determine why a certain prescription therapy doesn't work in certain patients and to spread that knowledge to doctors, maybe in conjunction with a diagnostic tool that pinpoints the right patients for a particular medicine. The result will be fewer treatments that are costly and futile, fewer patients with dashed hopes, and the flip side, more unmistakable benefit. The second key element of Lilly's strategy going forward is to speed up the process of developing new medicines with every insight and means at our disposal. We aim to reverse the innovation drought, good old gorilla number two. The current list of Lilly's molecules in some stage of human testing today is larger than it has ever been in the history of the company. Last year, we moved 16 new molecules into initial clinical testing, nearly doubling the size of that portfolio, and we're expecting to add up to 15 more this year. Those are big numbers, but if these molecules were chickens, you could fairly accuse me of counting them before they hatch. What I can promise you, however, is that we're putting our strategic emphasis squarely on the hatching. We're flat out rejecting the conventional wisdom that says it must take 10 to 15 years and $1 billion plus to bring a single new molecule to patients. And in a moment, I'll share some specifics. The final piece of Lilly's strategy really ties the previous planks together. In the end, our goal is to significantly improve the value that our products represent in the healthcare marketplace. If we deliver unambiguous benefit to patients, confirmed by doctors using their therapeutic criteria and by payers using their economic criteria, then the value of what we deliver is bound to go up. Similarly, if we develop new products more quickly, then the true value added by innovation will come to the fore sooner rather than the costs added by delay. To recap and to be very clear, Lilly's strategy is to create value for shareholders by accelerating the flow of innovative new medicines that provide improved outcomes for individual patients. That's it. That's our target. But I want to take you this afternoon just a little bit deeper through some of the key areas of focus that will enable this strategy with concrete examples of the actions we're taking. One of my reasons for doing this is to help you as community leaders better understand the news that you've been hearing out of Lilly and the news that you'll continue to hear in the years ahead. Individually, in bits and pieces, the news stories might not seem to make sense. They might even provoke some anxiety. But taken together, it will continue to add up, I believe, to a very positive story about the transformation of our business. I'm going to proceed quickly through five areas of activity that support this strategy I shared with you this afternoon. First, there will be no part of Lilly left untouched by our commitment to being more patient-centered and more customer-focused. Being patient-centered means changing the work of our laboratories in a big way. We call what we're aiming for tailored therapies, or tailoring for short. Tailoring takes many forms. In the early stages of R&D, tailoring can mean customizing molecules like antibodies and proteins to come up with entirely new treatment approaches. For example, with the help of some amazing technology developed by a company that Lilly acquired in 2004 called AME, our scientists have literally designed a molecule that may help treat the significant percentage of patients who do not respond well to Rituxan, which is used today to treat non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Later in the development process, tailoring shapes our clinical trial work more and more. That's certainly been the case with Prasugrel, a molecule we've developed alongside Daiichi Sankyo for acute coronary syndrome. It's currently being reviewed by the FDA, and its phase 3 trials told us quite a bit about the kinds of patients most likely to benefit from this prospective medicine and those who won't. Today, there's hardly a molecule or an approved product anywhere in Lilly's pipeline or portfolio that is not the subject of tailoring. We want to give doctors the ability to say to patients, Mrs. Smith or Mr. Jones, this Lilly medicine is not for everyone, but it is for you. As I said earlier, when we're able to do this, we'll vastly increase the therapeutic value of our medicine and greatly reduce the economic toll exacted today by spending on medicines that don't work. Of course, if doctors are going to have more productive conversations with Mrs. Smith and Mr. Jones, then we'll also need to change how we interact with doctors. So our sales force has an important role to play in tailoring as well. Earlier this summer, we launched an entirely new sales model in two Midwestern states, which we hope to expand to the rest of the country. Instead of those frantic 30-second sales speeches and a slew of reminder items, we're giving our sales representatives new tools and resources to meet the needs of individual doctors and respond to what doctors tell us they're really looking for. Things like quick answers to specific questions and more help for patients when their needs might go beyond the medicine itself. Tailoring takes us straight into a second set of changes that you'll be hearing more and more about, and that's Lilly's more aggressive move into biotechnology. Today, Lilly is certainly no stranger to biotech. In fact, if you pulled out the sales of bioproducts in our existing portfolio, including our insulins, we'd already be the fifth largest biotech company in the world, with upwards of $6 billion in annual sales. And fully one-third of those molecules in our pipeline today are of biological origin. Still, our ambition is to make biotech products an even more prominent part of Lilly's total mix, building on some key advantages that we already have. Today, Lilly is virtually unique among existing biopharma companies in that we're able to marry up deep therapeutic knowledge in targeted disease areas with the capability of generating potential biotech solutions alongside more traditional chemistry-based work. A good example of this is in the high-stakes fight against Alzheimer's disease. Lilly currently has both a chemical compound targeting Alzheimer's and a biotech molecule, an antibody, both in or near large phase 3 trials. Biotechnology harnesses the fundamental power of human biology to combat diseases. In fact, biotech compounds often lend themselves particularly well to tailoring. Sometimes we can dial in desired properties or target particular disease variations or patient groups, such as the example I just gave you for non-Hodgkin's. In other cases, we might dial out properties that are linked with less desirable outcomes or even harmful side effects. We call this protein engineering. This is why Lilly recently dedicated a $1 billion biotech development campus here in Indianapolis at our Lilly Technology Center, and why we broke ground last April for a new biotech manufacturing facility in Ireland. Transforming Lilly, of course, means more than new technologies in our labs. It means the entire company operating in a faster, leaner, more efficient way than ever before. We're starting at the top. By the end of this year, we'll have completed a company-wide effort to reduce the layers of management between me and the person on the shop floor, and to give our managers greater spans of control. It's really all about giving Lilly people more autonomy and speeding up decision-making. At the same time, and for many of the same reasons, we're developing new forms of collaboration outside our own walls, and I'll talk about that in a little more detail in just a moment. We're also paying close attention to our headcount. From roughly the 1960s to the 1990s, Lilly operated its business with between 25,000 and 30,000 employees. Obviously, we bought businesses and we sold businesses during that time. Sales in that period went from about $1 billion to $10 billion, and our stock split 2-for-1 four times. Then in the late 90s and into the first part of this decade, we expanded our employee population from roughly 30,000 to nearly 46,000. Now, much of this expansion took place in anticipation of the 9 product launches that occurred earlier this decade, and it assumed that market conditions prevalent in the mid-90s, the industry's salad days, would continue. Today, it's clear that yesterday's assumptions are no longer valid. That's why, since 2004, we've reduced our global employment base from 46,000 to under 40,000 today. We've done this mainly through the careful management of attrition, in other words, by not always filling open positions. Our recent voluntary exit programs in manufacturing, affecting sites in Indianapolis and elsewhere, are part and parcel of this effort as we adjust to changes in our pipeline and changes in the marketplace. You can expect that Lilly will continue to push down on our overall employment numbers as we approach the U.S. patent expiration of our biggest selling product, Zyprexa, in late 2011, even as we continue to make selective additions of new staff in certain critical areas of the business and in faster-growing markets. Meanwhile, about 400 of our employees worldwide are now working full-time as Six Sigma Black Belts. We have a couple thousand more Lilly people who are trained as Green Belts. These folks are helping us to take out work and costs, to improve the quality of our products, and to speed up processes throughout the business. In 2007 alone, the financial benefit of projects completed by our Six Sigma team totaled more than $600 million. Our fourth area of focus is to expand further Lilly's global scope and reach in all dimensions. My predecessor, Sidney Taurel, starting long before his tenure as CEO, quite literally put Lilly on the map for the first time in many parts of the world, steadily increasing the share of Lilly's sales accounted for by overseas markets. We aim to build on this important progress by expanding our market presence in key growth countries, including Brazil, India, Russia, and China. But when I talk about global scope and reach, I'm talking about more than market presence. Lilly's productivity push and our goal of casting a wider global net, these efforts really come together in a new organizational model. Of course, it's Lilly. We had to give it a name. So you'll hear this model referred to as FIPNet. Let me explain. For decades, Lilly operated as a FIPCO, a fully integrated pharmaceutical company, which owned everything from idea generation to sales, spanning the whole development pipeline, along with all of the costs and risks that go along with it. FIPNet still stresses the integration aspect, with Lilly assembling and orchestrating the network, but more and more of the pieces will be linked through partnerships, alliances, and other transactions, rather than always through outright ownership. Lilly cannot succeed as an innovator in the 21st century if we're maintaining capacity we no longer need, or undertaking tasks that others can perform better or for less. Yet FIPNet is not a frenzied outsourcing effort. We will keep our truly critical core capabilities in-house to be sure, and it will be quite important for Lilly to hang its own shingles in today's major hubs of biotech R&D. Today, San Diego is arguably ground zero for biotech, and we've gained an important foothold there through the AME acquisition that I mentioned earlier, as well as our recent acquisition of SGX, a biotech company with unique technology for finding new molecules. New forms of collaboration greatly increase the chances that we can tap the right bit of specialized knowledge or work at the right time, regardless of where it's located. And they give us much greater flexibility, a means of doing more things in more places at the same time. To begin with, Lilly today fosters a large concentration of partnerships right here in Indiana, building on the 3,000 supplier relationships we already have in this state. For example, we recently signed a 10-year contract with a Bloomington firm called Bioconvergence for materials management, and we've added a string of other Indiana businesses to FIPNet as well. But the build-out of FIPNet is ultimately not constrained by borders. Today, we're testing new collaborations with life sciences firms in China and India. Lilly scientists still design our compounds, for example, but a large number of our chemistry-based molecules are now synthesized by a firm in Shanghai called Shang Pharma. In India, meanwhile, we've handed off some molecules using new risk-sharing deals. We have the right to buy back these molecules once our Indian collaborators succeed in establishing proof of concept in the clinic. FIPNet has other dimensions as well, such as tapping private investment funds to spread the risks of our late-stage R&D and putting our own funds to work in biotech startups. Operating a FIPNet with all of this activity creates what Dr. Rob Armstrong, one of Lilly's R&D leaders, describes as a mirror pipeline. So in addition to our traditional pipeline, which I described earlier, Lilly is now linked through our partnerships, investments, and risk-sharing agreements to yet another portfolio of scientific assets. Lilly has less direct control over these assets, but also less risk and exposure. This mirror pipeline effectively expands our range of opportunities and significantly enhances our growth prospects in the years ahead. My final stop in this rundown of what Lilly is doing to implement its strategy is diversification. That's a loaded term, to be sure, so I want to explain what it means today at Lilly. We do not plan to stray from our core business anytime soon. So rest assured that having generated more than $5 billion in operating cash flow last year, Lilly will not be buying back Elizabeth Arden. Sorry, ladies. We still have things at home from the last gift box I think I got in 1985. Right, Sarah? Not that I'm looking, okay? Nor are we looking to undertake a large-scale acquisition or merger. We remain quite clear that these sorts of deals don't make sense for us and they wouldn't make sense to investors. Yet it's fair to ask, and many of you have asked, wouldn't Lilly benefit from being more diversified than it is today? I think the answer to that question is yes, with qualifications. It's true that some of our competitors, such as J&J or Abbott, companies that are, in fact, diversified beyond their core pharma businesses, today enjoy higher PE multiples than Pfizer, Merck, or Lilly. On the other hand, recall that in the late 1990s, many pharma companies, including ourselves, actively sought to shed so-called non-core assets. The fact is, the prescription medicine business, despite the challenges we face, remains a pretty good place to be in the healthcare space when you consider everything from growth prospects to profit margins. So how do we walk this fine line? First and most obviously, we aim to make the most of our Elanco animal health business. Certainly today, Lilly's only business outside our pharma core. We believe the opportunity for new innovation in this space is ripe as global demand for protein grows and as global food companies seek quality, safety, and greater economy in their supply chains. Elanco is not the largest business in its category, but it's well positioned for growth. It enjoys a number one or number two ranking in the major food animal markets in which it competes, beef cattle, swine, and poultry. Elanco's recent acquisition of Monsanto's Posilac product will strengthen our position in the dairy segment as well. In 2007, we successfully launched a new companion animal business using the Lilly brand. We're literally talking cats and dogs here. You should expect us to look for other selected acquisitions in the area of animal health in order to strengthen, deepen, or even expand our current product offerings and our geographic presence. Likewise, with a very healthy balance sheet and a strong cash position, you should expect us to put our financial strength to work in the pharma space as well. We're constantly on the lookout to in-license promising molecules or even to make acquisitions that help move Lilly into new or complementary therapeutic areas. And, of course, our tailoring efforts mean that we're certainly paying attention from a business development perspective to the convergence among pharmaceuticals, certain types of medical devices, and diagnostic medicine. Keep all of this in mind, please, in the coming months and years as you interpret news about Lilly and as you consider our role in this community. We need to look at Lilly's impact on the city and the state in ways that reflect the real workings of today's economy. Today, whether we hire someone into Lilly itself or support another person's livelihood through another kind of relationship, the story is similar in terms of overall employment and economic stability. In fact, I submit to you that the flowering of new small businesses, some of which may become old large businesses, is an even better outcome for the long-term health of the regional economy. I'll give you an example. As you know, a few weeks ago, we sold our site at Greenfield, along with Lilly's operations there, to Covance, a contract research organization with which we already had a FitNet-style connection. We also announced that about 100 local positions in clinical data management would in effect be transferred to a company called i3, a subsidiary of United Health. And we transferred some of our monitoring of clinical trials to a company called Quintiles. What you may not know is that to date, about 85% of the nearly 600 employees affected by these decisions have already accepted positions with the partner companies or found new positions within Lilly. Meanwhile, these transactions positioned Covance for continued growth from a new greenfield base and led i3 to establish a first-time presence here in the Indianapolis area, and that's good news on both counts. I'd also draw your attention to the fact that Lilly has made more than $4 billion in capital investments in Indiana in the last 8 years, including that biotech campus I mentioned earlier. We're invested heavily in Indiana's venture capital funds, such as the Indiana Future Fund. And remember those 3,000 suppliers we work with in this state as well. The growing concentration of the life sciences in central Indiana, spanning academia, private business, hospitals, and venture capital, makes this part of the world a very suitable base for the new Lilly. And it explains why we're such strong backers of BioCrossroads. Finally, I want to state clearly that Indianapolis will remain the corporate headquarters of Eli Lilly and Company. It will be the home of our U.S. affiliate, as it is today. It will be our R&D nerve center, as well as a significant manufacturing location. We're still a proud Indiana-based company. But, folks, this is not your grandfather's lily. It can't be anymore. I'm confident that the strategy I've shared with you this afternoon will improve not only our company's value to shareholders, but also our standing in the eyes of customers. Still, all these moves will amount to nothing if Lilly and its peers cannot earn and preserve society's trust. If in 10 years we're still talking about gorilla number one, the less than desirable image of the pharmaceutical industry, then we will certainly have failed. That's why at Lilly we're continuing to look for ways to be more open and transparent about our business. We've learned that letting people see for themselves what we're doing is the best way to build trust. A few years ago, we created the industry's first online listing of the clinical trials that we sponsor and the resulting data. Later, we put out the industry's first online listing of our educational grants and our charitable contributions. To carry that kind of openness even further, I'm pleased to announce to this audience for the first time that as early as the second half of next year, Lilly will become the first pharmaceutical company to begin voluntarily disclosing our payments to doctors for speaking and consulting services they provide. We compensate doctors for their valuable time, mainly to help us plan and execute our clinical trials and to help educate other doctors about our medicines. But once again, showing will be better than just offering explanations. I'm convinced that when people see this information in black and white, their confidence in what we do will go up. This database will be a large undertaking because the information is collected today in so many different places. The data will be available on the Internet, searchable in a variety of ways, and will specify, of course, the purpose of each payment. Transparency and trust together are the oil that lubricates the complex machine that is 21st century healthcare, and Lilly intends to remain a leader in this regard. Ladies and gentlemen, Eli Lilly and Company was quite literally created with a commitment to change. Colonel Eli Lilly told his son, when J.K. Sr. joined the company after pharmacy school, "Take what you find here and make it better and better." That was 126 years ago. But it's the same admonition that I'm trying to follow in 2008. Yes, we face challenges at Lilly, and we're responding to those challenges with an exciting strategy, put into action every day by the very best people in the pharmaceutical industry. Our strategy is aimed at improving outcomes for individual patients. That means clear patient focus, aggressive expansion into biotech, a leaner, faster company, a more global enterprise, and ultimately a more diversified business. In doing these things, we will bring forth innovation, which is the cure for what ails us, as a company, as an industry, and frankly, as a society. Among us today, too many people with diabetes are still suffering. Too many people with serious mental illness still can't hold a job. Too many people are immobilized by osteoporosis. Too many people with sepsis still die. And too many people with cancer won't make it to their daughter's wedding. So we have much to do. At Lilly, we've embarked on a transformation the likes of which our company has never experienced. We're doing this to strengthen our ability to innovate so that we can deliver value to our shareholders, remain a vital part of Indiana's economy, and contribute in a major way to human health progress in the 21st century. We're confident, we're fired up, and now I hope you know why. Thank you very much.
For those of you who are frequent visitors to our club luncheons, you'll see the question cards on the tables. If you want to write those and get them up to the end of the tables, we will feed them on down here. We do have a few minutes for questions. And just to start off with a softball here, John, on the upcoming presidential election, how do you anticipate either candidate's proposed health care initiatives will impact your business?
Well, certainly, as we've talked to advisors to both candidates, as we study their health care proposals, it's clear that quote, health care reform is on the agenda. I don't think you're hearing quite as much about it today because the economy and the things that are impacting the economy, the turmoil on Wall Street, gasoline prices, et cetera, seem to be taking stage front and center. But I do believe in 2009, when the Congress reconvenes, we're going to see a lot of activity in this area. Our industry, instead of trying to fight the prevailing winds, is actively trying to work with members of both parties to create, to help craft proposals that will enable us to have better health care accessible to more people, delivered more efficiently and effectively in this country. We believe, obviously, that pharmaceuticals are an important part of that calculus. We're going to continue to study the positions of both candidates and continue to try to be an active force for the kinds of changes that we think ultimately will enable innovation to make the difference that all of us expect and need.
Thank you. With China and India ignoring patent and copyright protection, how does Lilly protect their technology leadership and proprietary rights with joint global programs?
Well, sometimes with great difficulty. I think in China, I don't think we've launched a new product in China that wasn't already launched and out there by somebody else, okay? This is an unfortunate fact of life. And while we see great progress being made around the world in terms of some of the laws that should facilitate or safeguard intellectual property, enforcement is another matter. So I think this is going to be a continuous battle for us. Certainly, I believe that Chinese government and the Indian government themselves understand the importance of intellectual property as an engine of growth for their own economies. I think the practical realities can be a bit different, and we've had to be very careful and very thoughtful about that. Is obviously an important concern, Steve, as we broaden our reach, particularly in our research area in those parts of the world.
Great. Got a couple questions here that are going to combine into one, but it has to do with the cost of health care and who pays for it. But with your strategy around tailoring, will there be any impact on the payor community? And will that be able to get to the patients who need those tailored drugs, or will there be issues there?
I think, in fact, just the opposite is true. I think the more we can tailor our medicines, the more meaningful those products will become to the payer community. One study estimates that medicines today work about half the time. So if you believe that and you look at our nation's drug bill, you might argue that half of what we spend is wasted. Certainly the people carrying the brunt of that are the people that are paying for prescription medicines, whether that's the payer or the consumer. So I think the more we can establish clear value, the more we can say that it's this sort of patient who is going to most benefit from Cymbalta, this sort of patient that's going to most benefit from Byetta, and have the data that really demonstrates that from both an economic and a therapeutic standpoint, I think the payers will say, this is the kind of product we want on our formulary because it's clear we're getting our money's worth.
Great. A couple other questions related to the R&D and targeting. I'll just read this question. I think it's sort of meant to be funny, but do you think advertising Cialis during primetime football games helps the image of Lilly in the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, I would have been disappointed if we didn't get that question. We take quite seriously our obligation to, first of all, inform patients about specific medical issues and disease treatment options. We have direct-to-consumer advertising now for three of our products, Cymbalta, Cialis, and also Avista. We've been very careful and very thoughtful about where we place our Cialis ads. It's clear to me that we're still not satisfying everyone in terms of the placement and timing of those ads. We recently had a terrific dialogue with the major television parents group in California. Deirdre Conley, our Lilly USA leader, met with them to explain the approach we're taking. They want to partner with us. We, in fact, shared with them some things they didn't know that they weren't aware of. I think you're also going to see that our industry, our trade association, is going to be tightening up on our own direct-to-consumer guidelines because while we think these ads are valuable and important, and, in fact, we measure that by virtue of people who do seek treatment who probably never would have sought treatment before, at the same time, we need to be aware of and sensitive to these concerns. And we're going to try to do just that.
And maybe just an extension on that, how would you answer the question of whether that's taking resources and effort from other disease areas that might not be as profitable but are as perhaps have a bigger social impact, like HIV, tuberculosis, cancer, et cetera?
We try to balance all of these things out. Certainly not every type of pharmaceutical product benefits from direct-to-consumer advertising. At the same time, in some cases, it may be more efficient for us to spend a dollar doing direct-to-consumer advertising than adding 10 more sales reps to call on doctors. So we see it part of a mix of channels that we're pursuing. And obviously, when you mention TB, you know, Lilly, again, I think really led 6 or 7 years ago when we launched our global MDR TB initiative to try to tackle the toughest type of TB, so-called multi-drug resistant TB, by transferring technology. Purdue University is one of our partners here, transferring the technology to make two older Lilly medicines available in South Africa, in Russia, in China, and in India. That program, so far, we've invested about $150 million in that, and our commitment to that will extend well into the next decade.
Changing gears just a little bit, somebody would like to know how your background in science, as opposed to your business background, affects your decision-making at Lilly.
That's a question I get a lot. The other one I enjoy, people ask where I got my MBA, and I tell them from the School of Hard Knocks, okay? I don't have an MBA, so I've had to learn a lot of the business aspects along the way. I think that while I don't cast myself as our chief scientist, that's Steve Paul's job, I think my background enables me to ask good questions when the teams bring me, you know, updates on certain of our pipeline molecules, and they'll say, we've got this opportunity or we're having this kind of challenge. I'm comfortable with that. I'm at home, you know, with the jargon and the discussion. So, you know, I'm hopeful that my experience, most of which has been in the area of drug development through my career, can help us accelerate the flow of innovation. But as I say that, I'm looking over my shoulder at 39,000 people and saying, right? They're the ones that they really have to do this, and I'm confident they will.
Final question. And I was interested about your comments about the bioscience industry that we've seen grow so much here in central Indiana, and also your comment about San Diego as being the headquarters. But maybe paint a picture of what the future of our economy could look like here with biosciences and your strategy to network in all these partners. And I agree very much with your concept of investing and creating partnerships.
Well, I'm very bullish on the future of the biosciences in this region. But again, I don't think, you know, while we've made a lot of progress in the last several years, I just don't think we dare look over our shoulders. Satchel Paige says something might be gaining on us. David Johnson and his team have a very creative idea on how we can actually take advantage of San Diego. There, in San Diego, you have hundreds of little biotech companies, but you have very little what we call development companies like Covance that can take that idea and actually begin to do the work that takes that molecule into the clinic. So David Johnson and his team have said to the group in San Diego, we'll build up that infrastructure in Indianapolis, and obviously Covance and I3 are good examples, and we'll be your partner in terms of helping these small companies in the San Diego area have a unified point of focus for getting that kind of work done. Similarly, people say to me all the time, well, there's India and China. What about central Indiana? I think we've got to fight the temptation to make this an either-or. You know, is Lilly going to do work here, or is it going to do work somewhere else? I believe that the work we're doing today in those two countries, for example, you know, far from sort of diminishing our presence here, are contributing to the kind of vitality and the sort of pipeline and ultimately strength of Lilly that can only help make this community stronger and better.
That was Eli Lilly President and CEO John Lechleiter. He's been in that position for about 6 months. Bill Steffen is Indiana University Vice President for Engagement. He coordinates and connects the university's vast intellectual and creative resources with strategic opportunities that foster Indiana's economic growth. He's concerned about bringing life sciences and health industries to Indiana. IU and Purdue universities are asking the Indiana General Assembly to appropriate $35 million for the life sciences in each year of the 2009-2011 state biennial budget.
You know, there's been a lot of growth in terms of the state attracting, pharmaceutically based industry, Medco being probably the largest example of that. So I think we're going to continue to see Indiana as being a hotspot for that particular component of the life sciences sector, life and health sciences sector. What we're beginning to see, I think, more and more is we're developing some sophistication in Purdue, certainly with regard to NIU cancer therapies and research. There has been longstanding activity between Purdue researchers and Indiana University School of Medicine researchers and faculty members, physicians, in terms of looking at new interventions and treatments for cancer. And what we're finding is that we have more sophistication now in terms of both research, diagnosis, and treatment for various cancers and interventions at the molecular level that historically has not always been the case. So I think that's one area where we're going to see more progress being made, and that's an exciting development, I think, for Indiana relative to a very dreaded disease. We're also, I think, in terms of as you look at Purdue and device manufacturing and interventions at kind of a nano level, nanotechnology level, we're seeing more and more happening there that holds great promise. And I think just generally in terms of molecular interventions for various diseases, I mentioned Richard DeMarkey's work and areas that will affect type 2 diabetes and obesity. Those are all areas I think are very promising for new growth and development. It's encouraging to see the growth of the relationships between key research institutions. We talked a lot about Indiana University and Purdue University, but University of Notre Dame is also becoming much more involved in this arena as well. We're looking forward to closer collaboration with our colleagues in South Bend. The University School of Medicine has a medical education center on the Notre Dame campus that's expanding. Notre Dame's developing a research and technology park and will be involved, I think, to a greater degree with our colleagues at Notre Dame as well, which I think, again, bodes well for the state of Indiana when you have three institutions like Indiana, Purdue, and Notre Dame all involved in a collaborative effort that holds great promise. So I think that's significant. And we're looking forward at Indiana University just to, more activity in terms of business incubation services. We're building a new incubator facility in Bloomington that we hope will break ground later this fall and be operational by next summer. We'll probably be expanding the capacity of our incubator facility here in Indianapolis. So I think this is a wonderful time for exciting developments in an area that I think has great significance for the state of Indiana in terms of our economic future.
That's Bill Steffen of Indiana University. He's the vice president for engagement there. Steffen is also supporting the Indiana Innovations Alliance website. The site promotes an unprecedented broad-based research alliance to help the state grow its bio and life sciences industries, improve health, and increase the number of physicians trained in Indiana. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. The speaker for October is William Crystal, editor of the political magazine The Weekly Standard and a contributor to Fox News Sunday. His weekly New York Times column features commentary on the 2008 presidential election. Be sure to join us then. Thanks for listening. I'm Mary Hartnett.
ProLiance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.